Producing and hosting Town Hall Ohio is one of my favorite jobs here at Farm Bureau. I enjoy having the chance to invite thoughtful people to sit down and share their stories and their insights with all of you. As I look back over the past year, we did have some pretty good shows, including the First Lady of Ohio Politics, Joanne Davidson, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, Connie Schultz, experts in food and farming, science, economics, and consumer trends. Well, today we're going to rewind some of the 2017 highlights on Town Hall Ohio.
This is Town Hall Ohio, home to interesting people, engaging issues, and enlightening stories. Town Hall Ohio is a production of the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation, working to forge a partnership between farmers and consumers, and is supported by Nationwide. Nationwide is on your side. Now, here's Town Hall Ohio host, Joe Corneli.
We welcome you to the show and open up by hoping you and the family had a great holiday season, and of course, our best wishes for a great new year. To close out 2017, we're going to listen back to a few highlights of the past year's programs. We're going to begin with someone recognized as the First Lady of Ohio Politics, Joanne Davidson, the first female Speaker of the Ohio House. The 90-year-old icon is a testament to the fact that you can have strong political beliefs, but still get things done by working with the folks who don't always agree with you. Ms. Davidson believes that one of the roadblocks to more civil politics is that lawmakers don't really have a chance to get to know one another. And one cause of that is that we limit the terms of our elected officials.
Obviously, I was subject to term limits myself, so I can speak from experience. But when I came into the legislature, I depended upon legislators that had been there 10, 15, 20 years. Bob Nestle, Bill Batchelder. I mean, you know the people that had been there for a long period of time. And you spent time, and you had time, that there was a difference. You were able to make friendships, not just in your own caucus, but across the aisle. And so you would debate all day, and after it was all over, you'd go out someplace and get dinner together or something like that. And it just has changed because term limits now, somebody comes in the door, they know they've got 8 years. They're coming in probably for something that they believe is important and personal that they're dedicated to. And so they just feel that they've got to move. They can't sit on the back bench anymore, actually, and learn the structure as much. And there's not as many opportunities for relationships, building relationships, long-term relationships that really were the meat of what I inherited and which I became a part of.
I asked Ms. Davidson about being the first woman to serve as Speaker of the Ohio House. She said it was an issue at first.
After the first maybe 6 months, I mean, they quit commenting on what clothes I was wearing to session or something like that, which I never understood what that meant anyway. But it kind of was. And then I had one experience to prove I was tough enough. It was one early morning, which you don't want to do an early morning session. I'll say it very quickly. We were down in the old Supreme Court building, which is now the new Supreme Court building. And so I had a piece of glass in front of me, and it was after midnight. Things were getting out of order a little bit, so I decided it was time to bring it down. I brought my gavel down and broke the glass, and it shattered, and it went every place. After that, no one asked me if I was tough enough to be Speaker.
The only thing that could make that a little bit more entertaining is if it had been a glass ceiling that you shattered.
Well, in many ways, you could use that as an illustration.
If Joanne Davidson can serve as an example of civility in politics, the battle over State Issue 2 was pretty much the opposite. The weekend before Ohioans went to the ballot, Town Hall Ohio hosted Matt Borges, spokesman for the Yes campaign, and Dale Butland, spokesman for the No campaign. Now, the primary debate on State Issue 2 centered on whether the measure would lower prescription drug prices for Ohioans. But a second part of the proposal dealt with how legal fights would be carried out. Matt Borges and Dale Butland. Matt, your turn to go first. A big part of the measure requires taxpayers to fund the legal defense of the bill. Why is that a good idea?
Well, Joe, I'd only disagree with the idea that it's a big part of this measure. What this measure is about bringing drug prices down for Ohioans. I would just go back to, what's the common sense tell you? Why would drug companies have spent $70 million, the most that's ever been spent in Ohio history on a campaign, trying to defeat this measure? It's because they are concerned about taxpayers, it's because they're good people, because they care about public policy, because they know what this would do to their profits. And so what their campaign has attempted to do is just to distract and distort. They're running the darkest, dirtiest, most deceptive campaign in Ohio history, and they want to focus on every other issue besides bringing the price of prescription drugs down for Ohioans, because they know they lose on that issue. And so there is a provision in the law that would prevent the drug companies from doing what they always do. They've filed thousands of lawsuits around the country trying to keep government from being able to implement reforms like these. And this would give the people the voice in this process. Now, fortunately, our Ohio Attorney General, Mike DeWine, has already said that he would defend the law in court. But we've seen other examples in other states where politicians have decided to ignore the will of the voters. We need to make sure the will of the voters is upheld. That's what this would do.
So, Dale, the idea of the legal defense being paid by taxpayers, your thoughts?
Yeah, so first of all, Matt, complained about your characterization that this is a big part of it. Well, the truth is, when you walk into the ballot booth next week, you're going to see two paragraphs. It's less than 100 words long. The entire second paragraph deals with legal fees. And what this does is it gives the four sponsors of the ballot initiative, three of whom work for the controversial California healthcare CEO who is paying for this campaign, gives them an unprecedented right to intervene in any legal challenge that may be filed against this thing once it passes, if it does, and requires the taxpayers to pay their attorney fees with no cap or limit whatsoever on the amount of money we're on the hook for and whether they win or lose. Now, Matt will tell you, oh, don't worry about that. That only comes into play if the attorney general doesn't do his job and defend it. But that's not what issue two says. It says, read it for yourselves. It says the attorney general shall defend the law, and these four ballot sponsors get to hire their own attorneys too. Now, the reason that's important is that Mr. Weinstein is a serial litigator who has filed 52 lawsuits against government entities in seven different states, including three in Ohio. He's a legal bounty hunter, and giving him this kind of blank check could get very expensive for Ohio taxpayers.
Look back at Town Hall Ohio's hosting of a debate over State Issue 2. Dale Butlin and Matt Borges are guests. The measure was defeated by a 59-point margin. Politics was not our only topic of the past year. So, too, was science, and maybe a little bit of science and politics mixed. During a conference hosted by Ohio State University's College of Food, Agricultural, and Environmental Sciences, we went on campus to record a show on food science, and one of my guests was Nina Teicholz. She has reported for National Public Radio and written for The New York Times and The Washington Post. She is also the author of a book titled The Big Fat Surprise, which basically blew up one of the most sacred beliefs in dietary science.
This is all a conversation happening against this extremely stark reality of more than half, you know, two-thirds of the nation being obese or overweight, and more than half the country being pre-diabetic, right, or diabetic. And so, and the really obvious question is, you know, why is that happening? Why? It's all pretty much happened since 1980. So my book really went after the, looked at the fundamental advice for fighting disease. You know, it really started out with heart disease, and then it became obesity and diabetes, as those grew to be, you know, chief killers. And what I discovered was, that nutrition science is just rife with politics, that politics have driven this our nutrition policy much more than the science itself. But the science itself really never supported the idea that a low-fat diet was good for health, that restricting total fat was good, or that saturated fats, the kind of fats in meat, butter, dairy, eggs, cheese, that those fats cause heart disease. There was never good science. It was tested in huge clinical trials, really rigorous science, and could never be confirmed. And yet we still live with this idea that is basically hanging on due to sort of entrenched bias and, you know, industry support and institutional support. And so that's the part of my book that was hugely controversial, because that's one of the pillars of our dietary advice going back really to the 1960s.
Author and reporter Nina Teicholz making the case that sometimes we as consumers may be presented with information that may not be as valid as it seems. But how do you know what's good information or bad? Another of our top guests from the past year thinks we'd be better equipped to make an informed choice if we were able to apply some basic principles of science. Dr. Frederick Bertley joined us. He's a nationally renowned science expert, and in the past year came to Columbus, Ohio to lead the science museum, COSI. That's the Center of Science and Industry. Bertley is a self-described advocate for science literacy.
I'll frame it this way. You're expected to read and write, or in America, we're expected to read or write, period. If you're illiterate, you know, it's not a thing you're comfortable with, you know, et cetera. There could be shame attached to it. No one expects you to be William Shakespeare or Maya Angelou or the best literary genius, but you're still expected to read or write. It's same thing with counting. We're supposed to know how to count. We're supposed to know how to do our times table. No one expecting you to be Albert Einstein or Benjamin Banneker, you know, these amazing mathematicians, but you're still expected to count. For some reason, in Western society today and in the U.S., it's okay to have no understanding of anything science. In fact, sometimes it's a badge of honor. Oh, you know, I'm slow in science, or I was never good for that. And it's an interesting kind of paradigm we've set up for our society, because it's already from out the womb or from early childhood, it's okay if you're not good in science or you're not comfortable in science. That's okay. You can do something else. And I'm not saying everyone has to be a PhD scientist, but I am saying as a public, we need to be more literate. I mean, you talked about the farming community and the agricultural society. I mean, you couldn't find better or more long-lived scientists than farmers. You know, we have these stereotypes that a scientist needs to have a lab coat and thick glasses and be in a lab. But think about how the agricultural, I mean, you mentioned all the different ways that the ag community has moved forward. It's because of science. You plant something, it grows well. It doesn't grow well, you write fastidious notes. You come back the next season, you plant again. And then when you talk about genetically modified stuff, I mean, farmers and nature has been doing that for millennia. There's nothing new there. And so, you know, just getting people to appreciate that there's science in so many more things that they're typically not thinking about, and that you should be comfortable learning some stuff around science.
Well, you mentioned that the bar is pretty low in terms of expectations of science knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were going to create that bar, give me 2-3 things that the most basically science literate person should know or maybe be able to do.
I mean, that's Joe, thank you so much for that question. One is, in this great country, the greatest country on the planet, we still have 1/4, 25% of Americans still think that the sun revolves around the earth and the earth is the center of the universe. And there are populations of folks, actually 41%, almost half of Americans believe that humans and dinosaurs coexisted. How about this? I don't know if this happened to you, but it's happened to me. I've gone to the doctor. The doctor says, well, you know, I think you have a viral infection. I'm like, okay, bummer. And they say, well, we're going to give you a prescription. The doctor writes a prescription for antibiotics. We then go to the pharmacy. We hand in the prescription. The pharmacist gives us a bunch of pills, says take 3 a day, et cetera. Well, the doctor, who he or she went to medical school, allegedly, is giving you an antibiotic. Meanwhile, they're telling you they think you have a viral infection. Well, antibiotics are antibacterial. They have no use whatsoever to fight a viral infection. And now in these hospitals around the world, including in this great city, people are getting these terrible infections with multi-drug-resistant, antibiotic-resistant bacteria because of the misuse and overprescription of antibiotics.
COSI's Dr. Frederick Bertley. More highlights from 2017 Town Hall Ohio shows after this. Welcome back to our recap of some of 2017's Town Hall Ohio highlights. This past year, the news was in the news a lot, and more precisely, the practice of gathering and reporting information. Fake news became a thing. Well-known journalists were forced out because of inappropriate behavior. But if you agree with the idea that journalism remains important in our society, you're going to like hearing from Connie Schultz, who joined us a few months ago on the show. She is a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist. That was while she was at the Cleveland Plain Dealer. And she is now a teacher at Kent State University.
My answer about journalism, when you compare it to all the other ways to communicate, it's the least sexy, but the most important, I think. of the ways that we communicate in this country, because journalism, good journalism, is the last stop between us and mammoth corruption in government. And it, I don't know how you can have, I know you can't have a thriving democracy without a thriving free press. I make no apology for being a traditional journalist and championing the standards that existed when I first got into the industry and was one of the reasons I wanted to get into it. I still think it's one of the most honorable things you can do for a living. It's a mission, not a job. And so when we look at the changes that have happened, we see all the cuts in newspapers across the country. You know, when I started at the Plain Dealer in December of 93, we had more than 400 guild members. They have fewer than 100 now. And they are in three different locations. They've separated the guild from the rest of the newsroom operation. I mean, it's pretty stunning, as an example, to see what's happened with newsrooms and newspapers. A lot of our colleagues, our cohorts, are gone. They either had, they were laid off or they took buyouts. And I teach millennials because, first of all, I love millennials. I love journalism. And I am so concerned that we help train them, especially now as we're on the precipice of a Trump administration, that we train them on how to be the best they can be, upholding traditional standards and values of journalism while embracing everything that we have available now because of the internet and because of technology.
As she helps train the next generation of journalists, what's important?
Much of what I was taught in journalism school, I still teach. I teach mostly upper-level courses, feature writing, opinion writing. I'm going to be teaching ethics. This semester, we talk about ethics in all my classes, but this will be a concentrated course. And in many ways, that hasn't, the basic standards haven't changed. I always tell my students in the beginning of the semester, we talk about their values and their biases. And I say it's really important to understand both what you stand for and what can get in your way of seeing something fairly, not objectively. I don't believe in objectivity. It's a myth. We're humans. Anything we see, we refract through the lens of our own experience. What's important is to know where our blind spots are so that we don't let them get in the way of our coverage. So we talk a lot about that. There is no substitute for reporting, whether it's writing an editorial or a column or working on a feature story. You know, that's where my concentration is when I'm teaching. It starts with the reporting. And there is absolutely no substitute for it. You have got to be able to confirm what you've got. And this is an important conversation we need to be having in our profession right now.
Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Connie Schultz, should be noted that she is the wife of Senator Sherrod Brown. Ms. Schultz mentioned how journalists are working now in the era of Donald Trump. Any review of the past year would be incomplete without at least touching on the president's actions during his first year in office. And that was our topic back in May, when I asked for an assessment through that period while visiting with my guests, Steve Koff of the Cleveland Plain Dealer and Jessica Wehrman of the Columbus Dispatch. They are both in Washington, D.C. as their paper's national reporters.
It's interesting because I think we both asked a lot of people that question when the president approached his first 100 days, and it's not that far after now, and the general answer was incomplete. I would grade him pretty high on regulatory reform, doing what he could, getting rid of late-term Obama regulations that he did not want, and a lot of Republicans did not want. A lot of those were environmental. Some of those are labor. Some of those are still in the works. So he came in doing what he could with his executive powers. But the agenda from here on really is largely up to Congress. And that is going to be really tough sledding for a lot of reasons we'll probably discuss over the next few minutes here. So I'd say incomplete, but I don't think it's looking all that great for accomplishing a great deal moving forward.
I would say, I mean, I don't like to sort of say performing well or poorly or that sort of thing. I mean, I kind of hesitate to kind of weigh in on that front. But I will say, in terms of the things that he said he would do on the campaign trail, I think one of the key things was getting a Supreme Court justice. I have, talking on the campaign trail, there were folks who might have had some hesitancies about President Trump because he is a Republican, unlike many Republicans we've seen in the past. But they said, you know, they would like a more conservative Supreme Court. And so that was a definite win for, a definite tangible win for him. I would agree that the regulatory reform is something that he's been able to do, that we'll see more of. And now to do tax reform, though, as Steve said, and to do the health care reform, I think that's going to be something that has to, that really has to be in Congress's hands. So that's where, you know, that's the asterisk, that's a dot, dot, dot at the end of the sentence. So we see it, sort of see where it goes from there.
Ohio reporters Jessica Wehrman and Steve Koff, Jessica with the Dispatch, Steve with the Plain Dealer. They're both their paper's respective Washington, D.C. beat reporters. That was recorded almost 7 months ago, and in hindsight, Steve and Jessica pretty accurate on the predictions they made, which is no doubt a very tough task in a world where many things will change in the amount of time it takes to send out a tweet. We'll be back with more of our highlights of 2017 Town Hall Ohio broadcast, including some leaders from Ohio State University and a number of key environmental issues.
Drive, drive on down the field, men of the scarlet and gray. Don't let them through that line. We're gonna win this game today. Come on, Ohio, smash through to victory. We cheer you as we go. Our honor defends, so we'll fight to the end for Ohio.
Welcome you back to our recap of 2017 Town Hall Ohio highlights. And last year, as we do every year, we featured a lot of guests from Ohio State University. That's because of the long-standing partnership between Ohio State and Farm Bureau. Last summer, OSU Provost and Executive Vice President Bruce McFerrin and Adam Sharp, the exec for Ohio Farm Bureau, were together in our studio. And they talked about Ohio State's history and role as a land-grant university.
Well, back in 1862, in the heart of the Civil War, Lincoln actually signed into law the Morrill Act, which created a series of universities that kind of built from a classical university of the time, a liberal arts education, and said, let's not throw that out, but let's add in practical training. And engineering, agriculture, and military training were the initial components that were added to that liberal arts mission. And that has been durable over this past 150 years plus. You know, Ohio State is looking toward its sesquicentennial in 2020. You know, we were not one of the first land grants, but we got in pretty early in 1870, and I think have been growing in that mission. It was access to an education. You know, back in 1862, there were lots of universities, but not everybody had the opportunity to go to the university, and it didn't really prepare the next generation of people to open up the land and agriculture, to extend the nation through railroads and other manufacturing opportunities. And so the investment that the nation made in that series of universities really has continued to bear fruit, both literally and figuratively, in terms of what the university system can offer to society.
There's, you know, in our policy book at Farm Bureau, when we talk about our support for the mission, it specifically says to promote a sound and prosperous agriculture and rural life as indispensable to national prosperity and security. And, you know, that's right along that original Morrill Act.
Aligns
mission.
Very beautifully.
Yep. And that's something that I know a lot of good Ohioans, as we know, support and believe in very strongly.
McFerrin, who previously was dean of the College of Food, Agricultural, and Environmental Sciences, talked about OSU's commitment to what it calls discovery themes.
About 5 years ago, the university's leadership and board of trustees made a decision to invest in interdisciplinary science. And so the name of that program, the discovery themes, led us to embark on an intentional effort to hire faculty that were going to work across boundaries. We've had a great partnership between the university and Farm Bureau on things like water quality over the past couple of years. Actually hiring people to come in and work between the College of Arts and Sciences and the College of Engineering, the College of Food, Agricultural, and Environmental Sciences, public health. You know, those are the kinds of faculty we're bringing in to solve big problems in society by bringing their disciplinary expertise but committing to working on problems together.
Farm Bureau's Adam Sharp believes it is entirely appropriate for the College of Food, Agricultural, and Environmental Sciences to be one of the drivers of the discovery theme process.
That's what we've always talked about, is that the things that are happening in that college are relevant to everybody. And there's all kinds of partnerships and cooperative opportunities. Especially when you look at these discovery themes, those centered around energy and the environment, food production and security, health and wellness, humanities and the arts. You know, you can go down the list of those issues that we deal with in the food and agriculture and environmental sector and absolutely just check the box right down that list and say, yep, those are things that each of those discovery themes, there's a place for food and agriculture and the environment in there.
Bruce McFerrin's successor as the Ag Dean is Dr. Kath Ann Kress. She made her first appearance on our show this fall. The college and Farm Bureau will continue partnering on an important job, attracting young people into the college and into the agricultural profession.
There just aren't enough farm kids anymore for all of the jobs in agriculture. You know, all of the colleges of agriculture throughout the nation are only filling about 61% of the jobs that are out there. So, you know, we need a lot more young people. And we need young people to understand what a vibrant industry this is to come and work in. So that means that we're going to have some young people come who maybe have never been on a farm. You know, they're going to be young people who don't even have maybe a distant relative who's on a farm. And so part of that means we really have to think about our curriculum so we are offering opportunities that helps them get some of that hands-on experience as part of their education that we kind of assumed in the past that they came to us with.
What are some of the things you're training them for, some of the jobs that are out there that that you're helping them earn?
Well, jobs don't always look like the traditional agriculture job. While production is still really important, big data is a key part with precision agriculture. There's also a tremendous growth in areas that have to do with infectious diseases and antimicrobial resistance. So we're really looking for people who can be scientists and leaders, as well as those who are interested in production.
And what's the stats? It's a phenomenal number of the people that graduate from Ohio State are placed in their position pretty quickly.
Yes, there's 92% of our students who, when they graduate, either have a job or are already enrolled in graduate school. We're really proud of that, but we'd also like to see that number go up.
We'll return after these important messages.
Don't let the world ignore me. It's global warming day.
We are looking back at some highlights from the past year's shows. One I found interesting was a visit we had with the staff from the Office of the State Climatologist. Aaron Wilson tells us what their long-term data is telling us about weather in Ohio.
So here in Ohio, for instance, the things that we're concerned about, yes, temperatures are going up, but the data is telling us that our winters, for instance, are warming faster than our summertime, almost twice as fast, actually. We know that our nighttime temperatures are warming a lot faster than our daytime highs. So we're having warmer nights, but not necessarily as warm or extreme days during the summer. So those are the types of answers that the data is showing us with temperature. And Brian talked about the precipitation for sure. The data is showing that Ohio is receiving more precipitation on an annual basis, but that's not spread out evenly, you know, across all of the calendar months. We see strong trends in summer and fall precipitation right now, as well as spring. And we're seeing these intense heavy precipitation events, these events over 2 inches, happening much more frequently. And if you look back throughout history, there are 3 years back to 1900 where those number of extreme events even rival what we're seeing in recent decades. And that's 1913, 1937, and 59. And, of course, those were the three big major flood years across the state. And so certainly we're seeing these persistent changes in terms of the amount of extreme precipitation events we're seeing.
Jason Servanek says they want to use the data to help Ohioans become more climate resilient. An obvious group they're helping are farmers.
Certain producers want certain information based on whatever crop they're growing or livestock group they're working with. And that's really specific to whatever sector they're in. and making sure that that data is readily available and helping them parse through the specific vulnerabilities they might have in their operation and how that that information can help their long and short-term decision-making.
Farming, construction, other outdoor industries obviously need to understand what the climate is doing, but Servanex says they're not the only ones.
Ranges everywhere from hospitals that are thinking about their own operations, utilities that maybe are worried about extreme temperatures that might put a lot of demand on their infrastructure. And as the demand for the infrastructure is going up, you need more electricity, you have a higher heat regimen you have to deal with. If you're a township or municipality that's worried about putting culverts in, what's the maximum rainfall event that you can expect? And is that infrastructure you're putting in that's going to have a life expectancy of maybe 40 or 50 years, can it handle the demands you're placing on it? Or is it going to damage the infrastructure, cause a road or something to wash out? So the thinking about those up front means the investment you're making is more likely to be resilient and not cost you more down the road.
Jason Servanek of the State Climatologist's Office. One result from those more intense rainstorms we heard about is that Ohio's drinking water could be put at risk. During another show, we discussed the intersection of farming and water quality. OSU agronomist Greg LaBarge described the issue.
Certainly, we have rain events now that are much more intense, resulting in much more runoff that then results in more nutrients being moved downstream. So we have to adjust our management system under that type of scenario as far as climate and weather change so that we can reduce the amount of nutrients that are leaving our field site.
Farm Bureau exec Adam Sharp told us farmers are adapting to the new challenges.
The environment's not static. The way that we manage our farms is not static. So we're always learning more. We're always putting new practices in place. We're testing those practices. You know, we're working with government agencies, with Ohio State University and others, to test those practices and see what is the best benefit we're getting back environmentally. So it is. It's always changing. So we're putting in place practices now that we hope are absolutely doing the best, getting the best result that they can on the field. But we may learn something new just again next month or next year, and that's what's happening.
Despite efforts to understand this new massive challenge, there are people who expect farmers to fix the problem virtually overnight.
And that's not quite the way it works with non-point sources of pollution out there, because we don't have an individual pipe or we don't have an individual place to go and look for things. And there's been a lot of science in particularly the Western Basin because of the intensity of the problem up there, trying to identify what those problems are. And there is not one identified source of where this particular phosphorus nutrient is coming from, as far as being able to identify then that silver bullet, that one response that we can make out there that's going to answer all the problems. So we need to keep in mind that there's a very broad set of circumstances going on, and what those broad circumstances are still don't have a full identification of what that one best management practice is, and we'll probably never come up with one. It's going to be a suite of things that we need to do to correct the problem.
OSU agronomist Greg LaBarge. Water quality wasn't the only challenge that farmers and Farm Bureau took on over the past year. A couple of others include, what do we do about the problem of a lot of food being wasted? And what do we do about Ohio's drug abuse problem? We'll touch on those when we continue on Town Hall Ohio. Close out our review of some 2017 Town Hall Ohio shows. I want to go back to a program that included Brian Rowe. He is an ag economist at Ohio State. He helped the university host a conference on mitigating food waste, an incredibly large challenge and opportunity.
Yeah, food waste happens at every stage from the farm to the consumer, from field loss to losses along the processing chain, losses in retailers and supermarkets and food service, and then at the consumer level as well, in our homes, while we're out eating, all of that.
Something like, I mentioned 40% of U.S. food wasted and a third of the global food supply wasted, 1.3 billion tons. How does this happen?
how can we throw away this much food? What causes sure. this problem?
So I think there are different causes in different parts of the world. First thing to note is some food waste is quite logical. Going to zero waste will never happen for a good reason. We need a little bit of slack in the system. Sometimes we're going to buy a little bit too much. Sometimes things are going to go bad no matter how much we try. So zero waste is probably unrealistic. But if we look at developing countries, most of the waste there happens very early on in the processing chain because of poor transportation and distribution systems. So there's a fair amount that goes bad right in the field or very early stages of distribution, probably less so in the consumer's hands in these developing situations. In developed countries like the U.S., much more of it happens at the consumer level. In fact, when USDA crunches its numbers and looks at waste after the farm gate, about two-thirds of it is due to consumer-oriented waste, and only about one-third of it is earlier in the processing chain.
For our final highlight from this past year, we turn to a show that aired just a couple of weeks ago. My friend, farm broadcaster Dave Russell, attended the event titled Hope for Ohio. It was an Ohio Farm Bureau-sponsored event bringing in young people to talk about preventing drug abuse. The statewide conference got its start when some Eastern Ohio County Farm Bureaus decided to take action. Their Farm Bureau Organization Director, Michelle Specht, talked with Dave.
I think that this is a story about Farm Bureau at its best. Farm Bureau is a grassroots organization, and this started in my four counties because of county policy that stated that we should be working with our local Adams Board, which is the Alcohol, Drug, and Mental Health Board, and on addiction issues, substance abuse issues. And so that is exactly where it started. We started with policy, and then we put our policy into action. We did a lot of research on how we could help with this addiction issue. And the research showed us that we need to work in our own lane, stay in our own lane, and work on prevention programs and prevention programs with youth. Well, in Ohio, over 400,000 youth are involved in 4-H and FFA. And so they said the best thing for us to do is to stay in our lane, work with those youth on prevention projects.
So do you think the program met your expectations?
I think it did in the fact that of awareness. I think a lot of people had no clue. They heard it, maybe read it in the paper, but they truly had no clue how bad this issue is, and especially in Ohio. My county volunteers and leaders, we came down to Columbus, met with Ohio State Extension, Ohio FFA, Prevention Action Alliance, the Attorney General's Office. We brought that group together for a meeting in February and said, you know, why can't this be statewide? And so that is really how Hope for Ohio became. I'm hoping that everyone who attends can go back to their counties and encourage prevention programs with youth.
Jody Salvo with the Tuscarawas County Anti-Drug Coalition.
Dave, I have to be real honest. This is probably one of my more fun partnerships that I've experienced in a while. I was raised on a dairy farm, so familiar with the farming agricultural community. But as a child, I did not know the power, the strength, the influence the agricultural community, the Farm Bureau has within the state.
Quite a compelling story of Farm Bureau members getting their minds set on fixing a problem and then going about getting it done. That's what we do in Ohio Farm Bureau. We put our influence to work for Ohio's communities, for the food and farm sector. And we like to hold up the important issues to Ohio's farmers, but to all of you here as Ohio citizens too. And so that's why every week we appreciate you joining us on Town Hall Ohio. Happy New Year, everybody, and thanks for listening.
Town Hall Ohio is a project of the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation and is brought to you with the support of Nationwide. Nationwide is on your side. Join us again next week for Town Hall Ohio.